Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
They're pretty powerful people, so it's hard to imagine somebody taking Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke out behind the woodshed and teaching them a lesson. But clearly, something has happened, because in the past 24 hours, both of them have changed their subprime tune. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management. Committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 16th of October today, Tuesday. Great to have you here. The collective Washington economic wisdom about the housing market so far has been everything's going to be fine. Both Mr. Paulson at Treasury and Mr. Bernanke at the Federal Reserve have said, and more than once, that they thought the fallout would be contained. That's the actual word they used. But in a speech last night from the Fed chairman and another one this morning from the Treasury secretary, we learned that might not be the case, that problems in the U.S. housing market pose a significant risk to the economy. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
When it came time to assess the strengths and weaknesses of the U.S. economy, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was blunt.
The biggest risk is housing.
And Paulson says he doesn't think the housing market's problems will clear up soon.
It may continue a while longer as it is, housing prices stay flat or decline.
Paulson's take echoes comments Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke made last night when he said the housing contraction was likely to be a significant drag on growth for months. Today at Georgetown, Paulson outlined a series of possible regulatory reforms aimed at preventing abuse of mortgage lending in the future. But Peter Morisi, an economist at the University of Maryland, says Paulson and Bernanke's most immediate task is to nudge the market for mortgage-backed securities into action.
Paulson is trying to get lenders lending again.
Which is why the Treasury Department helped several banks organize a massive multi-billion-dollar fund to buy mortgage-backed debt yesterday.
Right now, everybody's frozen in place, afraid to act. They're all looking at the other guy to take action. And what Paulson's trying to do, like a grand conductor, is strike the baton and get everybody playing again.
But fixing these problems is not just a matter of Paulson tapping his sheet music and striking up the band. Paulson says some long-term regulatory reforms could take years. So for now, he's pushing private sector players to work together to avoid massive defaults. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Take it a step farther, and the thing that everybody's thinking about, but which neither Bernanke nor Paulson are talking about, is a recession. Housing could be a cause, as we just heard, but how about something else? Say, $100 a barrel oil. Run the numbers through an inflation calculator, and you'll see we've already been there. 30 years ago, crude peaked at what would be $101 in today's money. In New York this afternoon, oil topped $88 a barrel before closing at $87.61. But what happens if, or maybe when's the word, it hits triple digits again? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Supposedly, oil is spiking because traders fear supply disruptions if Turkey goes into Iraq to chase Kurdish rebels. But energy economist Philip Verleger says that's irrational.
Oil that would come out of Kurdistan can be replaced by Saudi Arabia and will be replaced by Saudi Arabia.
More importantly for the price of oil, Verleger says, are ongoing trends, like the unrelenting demand from the growing international economy, the U.S. credit crunch, which makes it more expensive for the oil industry to build stockpiles, and the fact that the Energy Department is diverting as much as 100,000 barrels a day into the nation's strategic reserves.
What they're doing is taking light, sweet crude out of the market, which is really like taking Chateaubriand or Chateau Margaux, taking the very best crude out of the market.
Verlegger expects to see $100 a barrel oil by the end of the year. But so far, neither consumers nor the overall economy has felt the pinch. The national average of $2.76 for a gallon of regular gasoline is actually 8 cents lower than a week ago, thanks to falling seasonal demand. And Tom Wallen at the Energy Intelligence Group says there could be even more relief in sight.
From the Caspian, from Canada, there's new supplies coming into the market in response to these high price levels. I don't think we're in a situation where we're going to have gasoline lines or anything like that unless we have some enormous geopolitical disruption.
The Energy Department warns, however, that heating oil and natural gas will be more expensive than last winter. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Remember back in grade school when you had the cool kids and then the losers? The Scripps Media Company took a page from the fifth grade handbook today. Broadcast darlings like HGTV and the Food Network on one side, old media slackers like daily newspapers on the other. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
The new Scripps Networks Interactive will include TV properties like the Food Network, as well as online businesses like ShopZilla. The EW Scripps Company will retain the newspapers and broadcast television stations. Gary Arlen once worked as a Scripps paperboy. Now he's president of the research firm Arlen Communications. He says the Scripps split is part of a larger trend.
It joins the parade of other media companies, such as CBS and Viacom, Below, and even the Tribune Company, which have been looking at how to split their dinosaur component, which is the old media, and the Gazelle, the new fleet, young, new media, digital media businesses.
Arlen says that separating out these struggling newspapers appeals to investors.
Wall Street seems to like that kind of movement.
In fact, stock in the company shot up more than 8% today on Wall Street.
The Street really does not give any credence or investment value to the future of newspapers, but I'm not so sure that the Street is right.
That's Porter Bibb with Media Tech Capital Partners. He thinks newspapers can be worth more if managed properly. And Bibb says that dividing the company could fragment Scripps management and leadership.
It takes away some of the potential synergies that were the rationale for building these media conglomerates in the first place. And basically, it covers up a failure to make the transition from old media to new media.
Though he disagrees with the strategy, Bibb expects other media companies will embrace this dichotomy, where new media get the glory and newspapers get used to wrap dead fish. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Yes, that is Dow 14,000 you see slipping away. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'd tell you, but then we'd have to kill you. That's basically what big telecommunications companies are saying to Congress. Lawmakers are considering an extension of a federal eavesdropping law, and Democrats have asked for details about what kinds of cooperation the likes of Verizon and MCI have already given. But in a series of letters that became public today, the companies say the executive branch won't let them tell. Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Perez, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Kind of a happy coincidence, isn't it, that as Congress is considering the new FISA rules, we're getting these letters from the big telecom companies. What are these letters telling us?
Well, Congress had requested that the companies give some kind of indication of what level of cooperation, what kind of cooperation they had given to the government. And in particular, they're trying to find out what help they gave to the National Security Agency after 9/11. With regard to the warrantless wiretapping program. The government, obviously, the president and the White House has tried to keep that program hidden, declaring it a state secret, and has pretty much prevented the companies from talking about it. But these letters were unusual in that the companies, for the first time, were defending themselves, saying that essentially we help the government on all kinds of things, and it's in the public interest to do so. And they're basically trying to counter the impression that people have that they may have acted illegally.
What kinds of things are these companies telling the government about us? It's people we call, it's internet addresses. Is it more than just that?
The FBI in particular and the NSA, they've been asking for things like your calling circle. You know, they want to know, they try to get the information about not only this person's data of what kind of calls that person makes, but who that person is calling and who that person that they're calling is calling as well. So it looks like it was far and wide that they were reaching.
Where does this play out as Congress gets ready to take this vote? What's the next step in this entire debate?
Well, what now is the big question is whether or not Congress will give these companies a retroactive immunity from lawsuits. The companies and the White House believe that they should get this because they believe that the companies acted in good faith. You know, the government came to them after 9/11 and asked them for this information, and they cooperated with it. The Democrats in Congress, and there's a lot of civil libertarians also, who believe that such blanket liability protection should not be given until we know what exactly they're being protected from. I mean, what exactly did they give to the NSA? And the White House is desperately trying to stop that.
Immunity, of course, presupposes lawsuits. There are some already flying around this very issue, aren't there?
There are. There's a bunch of cases that have been gathered in the circuit court. And so the White House is essentially trying to save the secrecy of this program by shielding these lawsuits, by blocking these lawsuits. And there's a lot of debate as to what exactly the White House is trying to save here. The White House says it's trying to protect national security, but there's a lot of critics that think what really they're trying to protect is some further embarrassment.
Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Mr. Perez, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
As Congress weighs electronic surveillance, the Europeans have been taking aim at another slice of the American high-tech pie. Last month, the European Commission won a landmark case against Microsoft. The commission had charged the company with maintaining a monopoly on computer operating systems and media players. Commentator Barry Lynn says Washington ought to think more like Europeans if it's serious about technological innovation.
Monopoly is good for innovation. It says so in the Constitution. Even before giving Congress the right to declare war, the founders gave it the right to declare monopoly, in order, quote, to promote the progress of science and useful arts. Monopoly is bad for innovation. That's also in the Constitution, which says monopolies should exist for limited times only. It doesn't take a fancy degree to understand what the founders were thinking. Monopoly spurs innovation by guaranteeing inventors big profits, but monopoly must one day end to open the way for new inventors. Ever since Ronald Reagan, Americans have forgotten how this system works. Rather than use our government to help new ideas rise, we let old monopolies use their vast powers to keep new ideas down. In recent years, a robust debate has erupted over the length and strength of patents and copyrights. Yet almost no one in America talks of the vital role that antitrust law plays in promoting innovation. Not so in Europe. Since August, antitrust officials there have launched formal cases against Intel, Qualcomm, and Rambus. They also won a big case against Microsoft. Not surprisingly, these American firms are not happy. They say Europe's officials are misusing antitrust law to protect sclerotic old businesses. Don't believe them. What Europe's governments are protecting is the interest of European consumers. Bill Gates has no right to collect an immense private tax every time anyone buys a new computer. Europe's governments are also protecting the ability of innovators to bring new and better ideas to market. In today's integrated world, this is good for Americans, too. So let's applaud Europe's antitrust enforcers. And rather than watching passively as European bureaucrats regulate our companies, let's bust a few tech-suppressing monopolies of our own choosing. After all, aren't we the people who invented antitrust?
Barry Lynn is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also the author of the book End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. Send us your thoughts if you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. And now, let's do the numbers. Stocks fell again today on those gloomy speeches by Bernanke and Paulson. The Dow Industrials lost 71 points, 0.5% to close at 13,912. The Nasdaq shaved off 0.5%, 16 points to end at 2763. The S&P 500 dropped 0.2%, 10 points to 1538. IBM ticked up 1.3% during the day. The company posted higher earnings after the close. Intel and Yahoo both fell ahead of the bell. Intel dropped 1% and Yahoo lost 4% as investors bet the companies would miss estimates. Those bets missed the money. Yahoo's profits were lower, but still better than Wall Street expected. Intel, meanwhile, reported record third quarter revenues. Bonds fell during today's session. You know what happens to the yield with that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on the Consumer Price Index for September. The Commerce Department releases numbers on construction of new homes, also for last month. And the International Fund for Agricultural Development, along with the Inter-American Development Bank, presents the first ever global map of migrant remittance flows. It shows how much money migrant workers are sending back home. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's a rare thing that a single segment on this program annoys two completely different sets of people. But my chat with Diana Nyad a couple of weeks ago about the failing fortunes of the National Hockey League managed to do just that. Stephen Hendrickson of Washington, D.C., a fan of the NHL's Capitals, wrote to say that we ignore the league's reasonably healthy financials.
It seems instead of trying to ridicule the sport for not being as bloated and overpriced as it once was, it would be more interesting to talk about the potential viability of a quality product with a smaller fan base.
Poker fans were the other set of disgruntled listeners. Diana questioned why something as dull as a card game draws more fans than players racing around on the ice. Stephen Murdoch begs to differ.
I get that what we do at first glance looks boring. I admit that after several glances, it still looks boring. This hides the sophistication of the game that requires a great deal of discipline to truly grasp the merest scratching of the surface.
We took you to Oregon earlier this month, up in logging country, for a story about the Bush administration's plans to open more land for timber cutting. We spoke with a county commissioner there in Douglas County about the good old days when logging laws were more lenient.
We were a healthy community where people could get out of school with little or no education, go out, work hard, support their family, and have an excellent lifestyle.
Dennis Moore from Washington, D.C. says, come on, really?
You can't do that anywhere in the economy any longer. Logging a few more fir trees will only postpone the inevitable. Good jobs don't come without good educations any longer.
On the sunnier side of things, we took a look recently at slumping retail sales, and we pointed out how many stores are blaming warm weather. Robin Sims from right here in Los Angeles says it's not sun, it's bad taste.
Everything right now looks like Gloria Steinem was wearing it in 1977, and that actually, she was more fashionable than this. You know what I mean? This is just supremely ugly. And somewhere are warehouses filled with really ugly clothing that needs to be set on fire.
And a few corrections to get on the record. In a conversation I had last week about the new Fox Business Network, we said Fox had replaced CNN in the lobby of the Dow Jones building. That's the same Dow Jones that publishes the Wall Street Journal and which is now owned by Fox's Rupert Murdoch. In fact, it was competitor CNBC that got bumped, which kind of makes more sense when you think about it. Our story about the dangers facing lobster divers in the Caribbean talked about them using oxygen tanks when they work. Who knew we had so many scuba divers in the audience? We should have said compressed air tanks. And when we reported on a new plan to use foreign languages in internet addresses, we said the Yiddish alphabet would be among the new options. Some of you wrote to say there is no such thing as a Yiddish alphabet. In fact, there is. It's based on Hebrew. It just uses some additional markings. Whatever alphabet you choose, use it. You can write to us through our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The National Retail Federation offered its official forecast for holiday spending today. $923.36 is their best guess as to what each and every one of us will spend on holiday-related items this year. That's up almost 4% from last year, although below the rate of increase over the past decade or so. The high end of the market has been largely immune to the queasy economy. Adults with disposable income have kept big-name retailers feeling no pain. But Andrea Gardner tells us the average luxury consumer is getting younger, much younger.
Allie, Sarah, and Amanda are talking jeans, expensive jeans. The 15-year-olds each bought a few pairs for back to school. Many of their wealthy classmates wear designer clothing. Brands like Marc Jacobs, Chanel, and Tory Burch. Others sling $1,000 handbags over their shoulders like backpacks. Allie says she knows the brands thanks to her subscription to Vogue, MTV, and clothing blanketed with the obvious.
Everything has a logo on it so that you know exactly what it is. The pockets of jeans. Show me any pair of jeans and I can tell you. Just seeing a stripe or something embroidered or a piece of thread, I know what type of jean it is. It's pathetic, but it's true.
Teens are a growing segment in the multi-billion dollar luxury market. And it's not just wealthy kids. Middle-class teens save up or beg their parents for Coach and Juicy Couture. A recent study found that 15% of teen purchases are designer goods, a number that continues to climb. Teens are so fashion-obsessed that they connect around certain brands. Girls at Allie's school wear friendship bracelets from Cartier. Issa Sawabini from the youth marketing firm Fuse says the luxe brands have targeted teen fashionistas with ads that feature young starlets like Lindsay Lohan for Dunian Burke and Keira Knightley for Chanel. They also created more affordable products for the teen budget.
The brands really expanded their product offerings. Louis Vuitton started making shoes and keychains and a variety of other accessories. So you didn't have to spend many thousands of dollars to kind of enter the world of these brands.
Teens typically enter the luxury market with an accessory or a high-end t-shirt. That brought sales to Christian Dior for years until the designer scaled back low-cost items to preserve its elite status. Marc Jacobs took a different path with his Marc line, now a teen favorite. It's lower priced than the signature Jacobs collection, though pieces cost much more than Gap jeans and sweaters. Designer goods or not, parents usually foot the bill for their kids, though shopping analyst Candace Corlett says today's moms have little say in the matter. As a result, more stores are designed for teens with dim lighting and loud music.
It used to be you wanted to be sure that mom was comfortable in the store. That doesn't count anymore.
Clothing retailers aren't the only ones tapping into the trend. Some car companies are marketing luxury to teens, with messages telling young buyers that a luxury car is within the realm of possibilities.
BMW has a brilliant campaign advocating how smart to drive around in a previously owned, heavily warrantied BMW. Kids are getting that message.
And whether it's with a car or a keychain, Issa Sawabini from Fuse Marketing says luxury brands have much to gain.
They've opened up a whole new marketplace, and now they're able to reach the teen and the parent, and of course they want to create passion and long-term brand loyalty, so these teens grow up with a lifetime of commitment to the brand.
In New York, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Ah, the Irish pub. Warm, inviting, and home to one of the world's best-known beers.
On any given busy night, we might go through anywhere from 3 to 4 kegs of Guinness. And that probably equates to almost 600-700 beers. 600-700 pints, if you will.
Robert Navarre attends the bar at Tom Bergen's Tavern here in Los Angeles. We asked some of his customers the other night what they think when a pint of Guinness lands in front of them.
Takes me home to Ireland, where the fields are green. And the Guinness is poured.
Green.
Very much pale people.
It's like an old leather chair, you know? It's comfortable, but you can't really describe why it's comfortable.
Bill Yenny's new book about Guinness is called Guinness, the 250-year quest for the perfect pint. Mr. Yenny, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Where does Guinness place in the pantheon of the world's great beers?
Well, it places number 17 worldwide among all brands. It places number one among all brands with a significant flavor profile.
It's an acquired taste, though. I mean, you pour a can of Bud and you pour a can of Guinness, and you're looking at two different beers.
Couldn't be looking at beer that is more different. I think that the acquiring of the taste is like the acquiring of taste for lots of, well, I hate to use the word, but I'll use it anyway, gourmet products. Part of the magic, part of the fun of those products is acquiring the taste.
Where is this beer popular? Obviously, Ireland and in the UK. Where else has it spread?
Well, it's growing in North America, and the third largest market is in Africa. Guinness has been brewed in Nigeria since the mid-60s.
Nigeria?
It's also Nigeria.
Why do you suppose it's so popular there?
Well, I think it's popular because it's a wonderful and unique product. And Guinness went into Africa recognizing that there was a huge market where there wasn't a lot of competition.
If you look at it, you know, Guinness is doing some things right because it's been around for 250 years. But how do marketers go out and sell this thing?
Well, I think that it is progressively easier because of the craft brew, the microbrew revolution that's been going on. And I think that has created a huge customer base of people who actively seek beer with a higher flavor profile. Another dimension to all of that is the strong and growing interest in Irish pubs. Every town's got one or more, and people flock to those places, and part of the aspect of enjoying life in those types of environment is the Guinness.
Am I remembering right that Guinness back in the 90s actually sort of had a marketing campaign based on creating faux Irish pubs all over the place?
Yes, it did. What Guinness has tried to do is to provide these guys with the materials such as signage and color scheme suggestions and things like that so they can sort of recreate the ambience of an Irish pub.
When you order a pint of Guinness, are you buying the Irishness or are you buying the beer?
Well, I think you're buying a little bit of both. Part of enjoying the perfect pint of Guinness is the place where you do it and the people you do it with. One of the things that people look for and find in Irish pubs is that sense of camaraderie, that sense of community, that sense of fun. You're buying an experience.
The book about what might be the world's most famous beer, Guinness, is by Bill Yenny. Mr. Yenny, thanks a lot for your time.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we move along today looks like the glorious copyright-free days of YouTube are over. The video site rolled out new technology today that'll automatically remove copyrighted clips. You might reasonably speculate the move was in response to a lawsuit filed by Viacom back in March. The media giant was miffed that shows were making it onto YouTube and asked for $1 billion to make it okay, you know, just to concentrate the mind a tad. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow scuttled down 71 points, 0.5% on uneasy words from Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson. The NASDAQ dropped 16 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 dipped 10 points. That is 0.2% there. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on this program, the NBA's popularity scales new heights over in China.
I've taken a picture with about 100 little old ladies, and I don't know if they knew me or I was just the biggest thing they've ever seen.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.